Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to move this thing along. I want Van Turner to come up quickly for me. Pastor Keith Norman is the past president of the NAACP Memphis Branch Executive Committee, and he could not be with us today because his mother is in the hospital. We tried to pay tribute to Keith in March, and he was at Morehouse accepting an award. So is just for the record, let everyone know how much we appreciate Dr. Keith Norman. And this plaque says, thank you for your leadership as president of the NAACP Memphis Branch Executive Committee from 2013 to 2016. We pay tribute to you for your service and commitment to the mission of our organization as we continue to fight for equality for people of color. NAACP Memphis Branch. And Commissioner Van Turner will accept this in his honor. You enjoying yourself? I'm introducing the speaker. All right. I have to tell you that I am so honored to be able to introduce these two keynote speakers, but I have to tell you this story first. Members of Temple of Deliverance, Church of God in Christ, probably around 6 weeks ago, Bishop T.D. Jakes was in Memphis, and one of my friends, Alita Boyd, invited me to attend the service with her and another friend, Alandis Dobbins, who is here today. So I'm sitting in between the two of them, and I said to them, you know what? I need a speaker for the centennial. Alita Boyd said, well, what about Harold Ford Jr.? Alandis Dobbins said, what about Melissa Harris Perry? I was in Temple of Deliverance, y'all. You see who's here today. A scholar and an activist, someone who tried to drop a class she was taking under Dr. Maya Angelou because she was pledging Delta Sigma Theta and was fighting bronchitis. She was just tired, right? After a conversation with Maya, she didn't drop the class, but she did pick up a mentor. She currently holds the Dr. Maya Angelou Presidential Chair at Wake Forest University, the Executive Director of Pro-Humanic Institute and founding member of the Anna Julia Cooper Center. From my observations, she reminds me of that friend who you can just have fun with drinking a cup of coffee or wine and transition quickly into a deep conversation about the state of our country and the activism that must exist to make this world a better place. I am a fan. I've read her columns in Elle and the op-ed piece about the NAACP and her perception of the organization and her thoughts on how we can turn it around. I have to say that our keynote speakers were meant to be here today, and I am so proud to introduce you to Melissa Harris Perry.
Madam President, you have to know that you have a fan in me, as well as in my entire team. I sit with my team, particularly Melissa Tutwiler, my chief of staff, once a week, and she says, oh, you have an invitation from the Memphis NAACP. I said, well, you should probably call them. Now that the op-ed is out, she said, oh, no, girl. They invited you the day the op-ed came out. They invited you because of the op-ed. I said, oh, you said what? So I was loving you then. Then we got the email in which you said, your sorors want to present you with a gift and take a picture. I'm an AKA, you don't know how hard it is for me to write this email. I said, well, this is a This woman who speaks truth. Mr. President, anything you ever need, the answer will always be yes from me. My real job is and always was and always will be being a college professor. I can't help myself. I made a PowerPoint. I will go through it as reasonably as I can.
I want to say thank you to Mr. Stan Harris, who was serving the head table today. He's a Harris. I always notice a Harris. I was chatting with him a bit. I was standing in the back when I first got here. I was reminded of a story
I don't know if you guys remember the Starbucks Race Cup. So it's a story that actually involves Congressman Ford initially, in that there was a mistaken identity moment. Melody Hobson, Congressman Ford, were mistaken for the staff when they'd gone to a fundraiser. I don't know, for folks perhaps who worked their way up in a space like FedEx and corporate America, if you have that experience of being mistaken for the staff. Being mistaken for the maid. I get why we have irritation with that. I get it. I get why there's a kind of racial microaggression associated with that. On the other hand, Rosa Harris, who lived in Churchill, Virginia, who never had the chance to even finish high school, but who put my father and his twin brother through college. They went on to become the first dean of African American Affairs at the University of Virginia and the head of aeronautical engineering at MIT. She was the maid. So if you mistake me for Rosa, I look like Rosa. You should mistake me for Rosa. You should think I look like my grandma. You should mistake me for the maid. I ain't mad when you mistake me for the help. In fact, hell, I'd rather that you mistake me for the maid most of the time than whatever it is you think a scientist or a professor or whatever those fools are. So let me just pause for a moment and say thank you to the folks who made today possible. You can mistake me for Rosa Harris any day. You can also check your racism at the door. So, I want to say thank you, Madam President, because Mr. Perry, my husband in the back, is going to be advancing my slides today. My husband, James Perry, is the executive director and CEO of the Urban League in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Normally does much more important work than advancing my slides, but I don't have a clicker. So we're going to go on with the first slide. All right, and so, Mr. Perry, we're going to need courage today. And we're going to need courage, and as we were talking about with Dr. Angela, who was my college advisor, she often said of courage, courage is the most important virtue, because without courage, you cannot practice any other virtue consistently. You see, you can have other virtues, but you cannot have any of these other virtues consistently. Only with courage can you practice any of the other things that we care about consistently. So, make no mistake about it. Although we are in a moment when things are improving by certain measures, times are still tough. Now, because we are living in a fact-free moment, and because I am a college professor, I cannot help myself, I am going to do some empirical slides. You don't have to spend a lot of time looking at these slides. We're going to advance them really quickly, but I'm just going to show you data because, heck, I want to remind you that data exists and that some statements can be made and actually supported with evidence, just to remind us that, in fact, it is possible to make statements and support them with data. So here we go.
When I tell you the times are tough, I'm not just saying it. I can show you data that demonstrates that, in fact, although things are getting better, times are nonetheless still tough. Not as tough as they once were during our Great Recession, but still tough. And here's what I particularly want to show you. They are always tougher for some folks. Always. If you go to the next slide, there's a lot going on here, but if you're a young person, I just want to show you one important thing. See that dark blue line at the top? That's folks without a high school diploma. That's unemployment rate. And if you see that kind of purple line at the bottom, that's folks who have a bachelor's degree. So that's across from the early 1990s through the Great Recession period. I have to show this one to my college students because sometimes right around like junior year, they'd be thinking about like, I'll do something. No, just look, military across the nation. Like over time, being able to finish college makes a big difference. Sometimes you hear people say, is it worth it? Uh-huh, yes, it is. Now, we should make it more affordable.
Yes.
We may need to make it more relevant, but is college worth it? The answer is just yes. Yes. Now, here's another crucial one. On the next slide, and don't, oops, sorry, back, sorry, baby. Back, thinking, right there. Red line at the top, black folks. I want to pause on this one again for just 1 second. I promise won't make people get it for very long. But it's important to see this. African-American unemployment is double that of white unemployment basically always. Democrats are in office. Republicans are in office. White presidents, black presidents. It's important to see this slide, I think, because the stickiness of African-American unemployment is profound. And it exists in a space that isn't about presidential politics. It is profound, it is deep, it is deeply rooted, it is deeply rooted in the American project, and it cannot be fixed simply by changing the personnel. I want to flip to the next slide because the other thing I want you to see is that the folks most impacted by poverty are our children. And part of the reason I want you to see that children rather than elderly are most impacted by poverty is because the reason that the elderly are less affected by poverty is because we simply made a set of public policy decisions as a country. We decided after World War II to lift the elderly out of poverty through a set of federal public policy decisions. And we are right now undoing those choices. These are not choices that will always be true. The elderly aren't just not poor because they just be making better life choices than young people. It is because we built a safety net under the elderly. If we take it apart, the elderly will become poor again. If we build a safety net under children, they don't have to be. It's as simple as that. On the next slide, you will see what happens to work in this country. Now, for all of the discourse in this country about how folks lay up on welfare and how we got to just, you know, incentivize work, I would like you to see that what we've actually done in this country since the 1960s is we have made work pay less. That what wages have done is go down. That part of the reason that folks have made the electoral choices that they have made is because they don't quite understand why, when they go to work and they work all the time, the ends never meet. My father grew up in the Jim Crow South. Rosa Harris on her knees, and also a brilliant seamstress who could make a wedding dress without a pattern. Everybody in Church Hill wanted a Rosa Harris original to get married in, and somehow sent both those boys to college. My grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side. by the white folks. They are Mormons. It's all right. We'll talk about the answer to that later. Push hand carts across the American West. My grandfather, my white grandfather, literally drove a Wonder Bread truck. That's how white my white folks are. My white grandmother never worked outside the home today. Raised five kids. Sent them all to college. Bought a home and passed away with enough money to leave all those kids enough money to buy homes that you can't do that in America now. You can't. I'm not even white folks can do that in America now. Now, scroll the next slide. You think workers make nothing. Look what women workers make. And let me tell you, that's 70 cents on a dollar. Next slide, that's just for white women. Because I tell you what, if black women ever made 70 cents on a dollar, we might be sending it out up in here. So, we are going to need courage. And not just because of those things. We're going to need courage because the maddening is ordinary. It is utterly ordinary. And the evidence is everywhere. And yet, many refuse to see it. There is no doubt.
There is no question. All of us know that Black Lives Matter. We will say it. Black Lives Matter. Say it. Black Lives Matter.
And yet, it is hard to tell. Because Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Hydea Pendleton, Renisha McBride, Eric Garner, Makai Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, Eric Harris, Sandra Bland, Laquan McDonald, Quintonio LeGreer and Betty Jones, Maya Hall, Pierre Lowry, Simone Marshall, Alton Sterling, Philando Castillo. And yet somehow it is our grief. Is our anger that is defined as the trouble. So we are going to need courage. Courage is the only thing that allows us to practice all the other virtues consistently and make no mistake, times are tough. Now, I'm going to use Swift. I just want to set out just four quick principles of courage. The first, be open to critique. James Baldwin says, I love America more than any other country in this world. And exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually.
Notorious B.I.G. says, never get high,
no one's black. It's the same. I'm sorry, you can't, that it's, we got a little bit of, it came through poorly on the slide here. To the side that's dark there is just information that since 2003, the lowest quarter for fundraising for the Democratic Party since 2003 was this quarter. Now, I offer you that because, damn. That's what you call being high on your own supply. That's what you call not understanding where you are in a social and political moment. That's what you call being fully and completely out of touch and not open with criticism. That is what you call being prepared to be buried. Do not be that. So, folks, listen. I know I wrote a difficult op-ed.
I used to get hate mail every single hour of every single day. And let me tell you what I don't read. I want to rape you. I'm going to kill you. I want to rape your mama. I want to rape your sister. I want to rape your daddy. I want to rape. No, that is not useful. That is not critique. That's hating. That's cruelty. That's racism. That's misogyny. That's death in 140 characters. I don't read that. Here's what's valuable. MHP, I think you're getting this analysis wrong. I think you're not hearing your audience on this. I think this is where, oh, okay. Now, I will believe all of it. I will give, but not every critic is a hater. Not every critic is right. I'm an academic. Literally what our job is to pour our soul onto a piece of paper, put it into an envelope, send it to people who then, without having to even tell us what their name is, send it back to us and tell us why it's garbage, rhythmically, every few months. That's literally what my job is as a professor. I mean, that's what blind review actually is. That is the presumption of what makes us good as scholars, is that we pour our soul onto paper and have people blind review it and send it back to us. That's the presumption of academic rigor. Any group of people who do not stay open to criticism become Donald Trump. Or the current Democratic Party. Mistakes and failure are always a part of growth. Ask any chemist. Ask anyone who's ever become great. Ask any jazz musician. Courageous and adaptable people and organizations always care more about justice than egos. Dr. Martin Luther King said, "You may be 38 years old as I happen to be, and one day some great opportunity stands before you and calls you to stand up for some great principle, some great issue, some great cause, and you refuse to do it because you are afraid. Refuse to do it because you want to live longer. You're afraid that you'll lose your job. You're afraid you'll be criticized, that you'll lose your popularity. You're afraid that somebody will stab you or shoot at you or bomb your house. So you refuse to take the stand. Well, you may go on and live until you're 90, but you're just as dead at 38 as you would be at 90. We are going to need courage. Number two, build from the bottom. Matthew 5, 9 through 10 says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Drake said, "Started from the bottom, now we're here." I'm going to do this fast. Consider our current president. All right, I'm about to say some bad words up here. I'm just going to say it, because apparently we're not in respectability land no more. We have a president who just simply says, "I grab him by the pussy." Now, people have lost their whole mind when this man won. When this man won, people were like, "Oh my God, a racist is in the White House. Oh my God, a pussy grabber is in the White House." White woman was crying, they was falling out, they was passing out, they were just tripping out. Oh my God, there's a racist and a pussy grabber in the White House. Guess who was not shocked to discover that a racist pussy grabber is in the White House?
the reason that we start from the bottom is because when you begin at the bottom, you gain knowledge that only people on the bottom have. Now, the young sister who began by talking about where she began. The entire American economic system rests on grabbing black women's pussies. The whole thing. The Caribbean, South America, has a continual process of the triangle trade. Sugar slavery rests on continuously bringing the importation of new enslaved people from the continent of Africa for a very long time. But here, on the coast of North America, the importation of newly enslaved people from the coast of Africa ends relatively early. So how does slavery literally reproduce here? Through us. The only way that slavery continues, the only way that the peculiar institution goes on, is that black women have to give birth and then not own not only the products of our labor, our work, but our labor. The thing from our pussies are grabbed by the people who own us. Ain't nobody around here surprised that the people who run this joint are pussy grabbers. Everything rests on that. So much so that, in fact, infant mortality in this country is twice that for black women as it is for white women, no matter what our socioeconomic status. It doesn't matter if you have health insurance, economic status, education. Black women's babies die at more than twice that of white women, and you can't close the gap because it turns out it's not about poverty, it's not about health insurance, it is about racism that is intergenerationally tied to the reality of our wombs that have been stolen from us from a moment so deeply and profoundly connected to who we are in this country, that the idea that this stuff showed up in November of 2016 is to literally wipe away our entire human experience. If you'd have started from the bottom, would nobody have been surprised in November? You always have to start with the least of these. Literally, Jesus said. It is in fact the only way to organize. Don't ever start at the top. Never. Look. I am only going to say this. If you're about to shatter the highest glass ceiling,